This podcast of the Radio Cafe comes to you via radiocafe.org, where you can find more information and many other podcasts. Technical support comes from Studio X, providing website design, hosting, e-commerce, and social media marketing, serving Santa Fe to the world since 1994. Find out more at studiox.com. I'm delighted today to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Jack Leffler. We are here to honor the life of Rena Swensel, who was a Santa Clara architect, potter, teacher, activist, author, historian, and Jack worked with her over the course of 30 years. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you very much, Mary Charlotte.
Now, how did you know Rena Swensel?
Sometime back in the mid-1980s, my telephone rang, and a wonderful lady said, "This is Rena Swensel. May I ask if you could help me out?" And I said, well, surely. I'd heard of Rena. It was hard not to have heard of Rena because she was a force of nature even by then. But at any rate, Rena asked me if I would go out to the Santa Clara Pueblo and record her mother, Rose Naranjo, singing children's songs for posterity. And so indeed I did. And I must say that we set eyes on each other and realized that there was a kindredness there of magnitude. And we remained friends for the rest of her life. And I'm still here, but she's still my friend.
Talk about her contributions both within Tewa culture, Pueblo culture, and in the larger world.
Well, I can't speak to all of the things that she did in Tewa culture, but I know that fairly recently, she and her sister Tessie received a grant, and Porter, her grandson, and her brother Tito Naranjo put together a really terrific book that features both Tewa verbs and pronouns. Ostensibly, the Tewa language is a verb-based language. And so they wrote this book. They took all of the major verbal or the verb influences and the pronoun influences. And then on three different days, I went up to the Pueblo and actually with my recorder and recorded Tessie reading all of this book that they wrote, both in English and in Tewa language. And then I went back to my own studio and edited it as best I could, not being a speaker of Tewa, and gave them CDs. Subsequently, just about every member of not just that Pueblo, but others of the Tewa-speaking Pueblos receive a copy of this book called Cap on Tewa, Verbs and Pronouns, along with the CDs so that people can actually understand the pronunciations, which to me is a terrific thing because, as we know, culture and language are just inextricably connected. And as language disappears, cultural perspective goes with it. And this was something that Rena understood very clearly, as does Tessie. Her sister also has a PhD, mind you, in American Studies, and they're both two of the most brilliant people you could possibly meet. And it's interesting to me that they were able to bridge the gap between a culture that would have provided a PhD in American Studies and also remain within the context of the Tewa traditional perspective. They both have, very successfully. And what really has come through in the course of my life over all of these years, especially from Rena and with Tessie, is a clear understanding that today's monoculture is really berefting itself of a level of perspective that is available through the indigenous peoples who still remain, who are still in possession of a cultural perspective. And largely, one of the things that's to me is sine qua non throughout is that I have yet to meet and record a traditional indigenous person who does not regard habitat as sacred. And this is within a monocultural perspective, biased in favor of secularization of habitat and thence turning habitat into money.
When you say monoculture, you're talking about what, American consumer culture, that kind of thing?
It's more than that in a way. American culture is where we are, and that's the prevailing cultural phenomenon that circulates throughout this continent. that had its genesis back, you know, 300 years ago about. But the upshot is that it's now a global cultural perspective that is in making in short order, getting rid of this indigenous perspective. I think of it as indigenous mind. Every culture has its own perspectives, its own twist on reality. But there are certain things that are basic to all indigenous cultures, in my experience, having recorded Native Americans and Hispanos throughout the western United States, all the way down in as far south as Chiapas, even as far south as the Cook Islands. These are people who have a sense of the presence of the planet as being the parent, which is really a big thought. I mean, there's a level of kinship, a sense of the kindred that exists between the indigenous traditional peoples that I know and even the plants that grow. And this was something that Rena described so well over a period of many years to me. She allowed me to record her over a period of many years. And we collaborated on several things. For example, I produced a radio series called The Spirit of Place. And one of the first people I interviewed for that was Rena Swensel, who talked really profoundly to me about the Tewa perspective with regard to seeing all life as kindred, and not only just the life, but the rocks and the water in the air swirling around us. And part of that interview appeared in a book I did called Survival Along a Continental Divide, which came out through UNM Press several years ago. More recently, we received a grant through our 501c3, which is known as the Lore of the Land, to do both a radio series and a book that focused on indigenous perspectives regarding relationship of culture to habitat. And subsequently, part of that allowed for different people of indigenous persuasions to produce their own radio programs. And Rena and Tessie, with the great help of Porter Swensel, who was very adept at twisting the knobs and recording, produced a 30-minute radio program on the whole Puebloan perspective regarding the Rio Grande, which is a very important radio program in this series. That particular series is known as Watersheds as Commons and has been distributed through Public Radio Exchange to different stations around the country. Then we did a book called Thinking Like a Watershed that went along with this particular radio series. And actually, Rena wrote a fantastic chapter about her perspective concerning thinking like a watershed. In other words, seeing the habitat itself as helping to shape a cultural perspective with regard to sustainability within homeland. Recognizing all the while that there is a more predominant culture everywhere, and really reflecting very vigorously on how does the indigenous culture retain any sense of authenticity within its own perspective relative to this bigger culture, which is rapidly subsuming everything in its wake.
Everything in its wake.
So she wrote a splendid chapter in this book, Thinking Like a Watershed, Voices of the West. Also, that book came out through UNM Press as well. And then most recently, through the History Museum of New Mexico at the Palace of the Governors, I've been invited by my friend Meredith Davidson, who is a curator there, to co-curate an exhibition on the history of counterculture in the American Southwest and beyond. While so many people have sort of a narrow vision of what the counterculture really existed as it existed, I wanted to find as many different perspectives as I could possibly find. And so I invited my good pal Rena Swensel to write a chapter about her life as a young hippie in New Mexico, living with her husband Ralph Swensel, who was a really good guy. I knew him.
He was a tutor at St. John's
College. He was a tutor at St. John's College, and no dumbbell by any stretch of the imagination. In other words, they represented two minds that came together in a long and enduring marriage. He died in 2005, the same year that her mother and grandson passed away. So, tough year for that family.
Good heavens.
But at any rate, Rena and Ralph lived in their VW bus much of at least the warmer months in northern New Mexico, basically in Taos County, raising not one, not two, but three daughters in their VW bus as they camped all over Taos County.
All year round.
Well, not all year round, because sometime, finally, Ralph got a gig teaching at St. John's. But nonetheless, and they did build a house right here in town off of Alameda Street. And the upshot is that they were able to rent the house part of the time and be on the road because they loved camping in the outback where they felt close to the flow of nature. But the three daughters, the oldest being Athena, the middle one being Roxanne, who's a very successful artist in her own right, and the youngest being Poem. And these three daughters and Ralph and Rena lived in their VW bus. But the truth of this is I had asked, months ago, I had asked Rena if she would write a chapter for this book that I'm putting together with my friend Meredith on counterculture in New Mexico. Well, to interject something, I'd also been invited by people down in Silver City to put together a panel on our subject of thinking like a watershed. And so I'd invited Rena, my friend Enrique Lamadrid, and another friend, Steve Harris, to join me in Silver City for a panel that was supposed to have happened in September, early October. Everybody accepted, and as I was leaving for Silver City, Rena called me on the phone and said, "Jack, I just don't feel well enough. I can't go." And so I said, "That's okay. You'll be represented." And I took excerpts from the various conversations that I'd had with Rena and also a photograph that I'd taken and showed Rena, and we heard Rena, and she made a hit in Silver City. And I told her this on the way home.
Because by that time, you'd done so many recordings together.
Yes. I can't tell you how many, but quite a number. And on the way home, I called her to tell her what a success she had made in the panel. And she laughed at that. And then she said, "Jack, I have to tell you, I've just been admitted to hospice." And the malaise that carried her away had finally gotten to the point where she really was dreadfully weakened. But not so weakened that 6 days before she died, she completed her chapter on life as a countercultural person.
Oh, my goodness.
And then she began to slip out of life after she finished that. And her daughter Athena, who was with her throughout, told me about this. And it was just really, it really gets me. I mean, truly one of the most courageous things to have a final say about a perspective that she thought was worth including, and also as a supreme act of friendship to me to finish this project.
To finish this project when you're so ill. It's interesting to think about counterculture and Native American culture together, because you don't usually think of one as being part of the other.
Well, actually, I have grown to think of one as part of the other, because as far back as 1970, I was working very closely with both traditional and Hopi and Navajo Indians on an environmental battle to try to thwart the strip mining of coal on Black Mesa, which is a landmass sacred to both the Hopi and the Navajo peoples in northern Arizona. I had been asked by both the Hopis and the Navajos to start the Black Mesa Defense Fund, which we did in those days. This was also the beginning, not the beginning, but near the beginning of the American Indian Movement, AIM. And the AIM people were really trying to make sure that their own rights did not continue to be violated as we violated vigorously throughout the 19th century in the name of manifest destiny. And the seeds of manifest destiny keep sprouting up all over Indian country in North America, where extractors want to get to the natural resources. And so these people who had greatly influenced my thinking starting back in the early 60s, their perspective with regard to a relationship of culture to habitat seemed to me infinitely profound relative to the culture into which I'd been born and watched vast strip mining of coal in West Virginia, where I was born, and in Kentucky and other places. Actually, I just recently had a conversation with a friend in Kentucky, a writer named Wendell Berry, who actually got involved in civil disobedience in behalf of stopping strip mining of coal in Kentucky. But at any rate, working with the Native Americans, they were very countercultural in that sense of really trying to retain their own tribal rights to landscape, also trying to retain a sense of promise by the United States government to not continue to violate their traditional rights, and to really try to stop the strip mining of coal. Well, it was too big a project. We gave it our best shot for years. But the upshot is that a group of Native American people, and myself and my wife Catherine and I, and a group of counterculturalists, including Gary Snyder and Michael McClure, and environmentalists, including David Brower and Melissa Savage, we all went to the first UN conference on the human environment in Stockholm, Sweden. In 1972, we rented an art gallery. Stuart Brand was there, the fellow who did the Whole Earth Catalog, who had been greatly influenced by the American Indian perspective. And he wrote the handbook for the hippie, as far as I'm concerned. We rented an art gallery which became Third World Central, at which point people from third world countries, people who were indigenous cultures from all over the world, gathered every single night in that gallery. Another person who was there was Margaret Mead, wearing her black cape and carrying her trident. It was really a glorious thing to behold.
You have produced, and we're just about to hear, some excerpts from all the work you did all those years interviewing Rena Swensel. Can you introduce this for us?
Oh, yeah. Actually, as a part of the project that Rena wrote her beautiful chapter for, is also part of a grant to produce a radio series which I've called Encounters with Consciousness. It's a 10-part radio series comprised of 30-minute programs, basically. And to me, I've never met anybody more conscious than Rena Swensel. And I'd hoped to have one more recorded conversation with her, but she passed away when I was conducting interviews on the West Coast on October the 30th. And so I came back home and I went through all of these different interviews that I'd done with Rena over a period of over 20 years, let's put it that way, and selected stuff that had really turned me on as I heard it go by, as you can do. As a radio producer, you hear it and you recognize the meat when it goes through your ears. And now that's a bad metaphor, but at any rate. But anyway, the radio program that I'm so grateful to you for putting on this morning is actually a personal tribute of my own to my great friend, Rena Swensel. I produced this shortly after her death on October the 30th, 2015. And this will be the first time this radio program appears on the radio waves.
If there's one memory of your experience with her that you would like to share with us before you go, what would it be?
Boy, there are just millions of them. But at any rate, I remember one time I was interviewing her. I had been working on a whole project concerning the commons, the whole concept of the commons. Back in 1984, I had interviewed Garrett Hardin, the man who penned the essay, The Tragedy of the Commons. And that was a very profound thing for me to have read. And then the interview with him was profound. And then in 2009, our daughter Peregrina and I interviewed Eleanor Ostrom, who took some umbrage with Garrett Hardin's essay and wrote her own book entitled Governing the Commons, for which she got the 2009 Nobel Prize. And so I had the commons in my mind big time. And I knew that Rena had something to say about it. And so up at her house, I started interviewing her about the notion of the commons. And of course, Rena said, the commons is everything that swirls around us. And just then a great gust of wind came right through the window where we were, and we were both highly invigorated by this beautiful gust of wind that was swirling the commons of reality around us. And it was at that moment in time that I came to understand that the human sense of the commons is actually the consciousness of commons, the commons of consciousness. We share a commons of consciousness with every individual who has ever lived on this planet through the last 10,000 generations of humans from 200,000 years ago to the present. And that was a great epiphany to me.
Jack Loeffler is a radio producer, author, and oral historian. And we're going to take a break right now, and then we will hear a piece of excerpts of recordings that he made with Rena Swensel over the years. Rena Swensel, the Santa Clara Pueblo architect and potter and teacher and so many things. Jack Loeffler, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. This is an honor. Hello. For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Loeffler, and welcome to Encounters with Consciousness. The Santa Clara Pueblo is one of six Native American communities in northern New Mexico where the Tewa language is spoken. The Pueblo is situated on the western banks of the Rio Grande near the base of the Jemez Mountain Range, a supervolcano whose last major eruption is thought to have occurred just over a million years ago. The Santa Clara Indians are descended from ancestral Puebloans who have inhabited the Four Corners region of the North American Southwest for millennia. In 1939, Andrin Naranjo was born into the family of Rose and Michael Naranjo in Santa Clara. She became known as Rena Swensel, and is highly regarded as an author and authority on Puebloan architecture, art, and philosophic perspectives. While she attained her Ph.D. in American Studies at the University of New Mexico, she remained rooted in Tewa Puebloan traditions throughout her life. Today on Encounters with Consciousness, we'll listen to excerpts from conversations I recorded with my great friend Rena Swensel over a period of 20 years. I know of no one who was more in tune with the flow of nature.
I was born in 1939 in Santa Clara Pueblo, and I grew up with my great-grandmother there, right in the middle of the Pueblo. And at the time that I was born, there were no cars in the Pueblo. Isn't that just amazing? We didn't have the sounds of cars. There was a totally different sense of place because there were no cars. Everybody walked. And there were horses and pigs in the corrals and chickens in the corral around the edge of the Pueblo. We were still walking down to the stream, to Santa Clara Stream, to get our water at the time. People would walk down there. Later, there were some pumps put in by the BIA, by the federal government. But before that, we were hauling in their water. And we were, as Santa Clara still is, a poor community. But there were very few people at the time when I was growing up that were working outside of the community. There was still a lot of farming going on. Some people had some cattle, and of course a lot of fields along the Rio Grande which were being irrigated. But most of the activity was from the Pueblo into the fields and into the mountains to bring in the food from those areas around the community. And actually, you know, life felt okay, and of course as children's memories go, it was a wonderful place to grow up. Even though people told us how poor we were, it was still a wonderful place. I mean, we seldom had shoes that we could... I mean, it was so exciting when we got a pair of shoes. But our feet were used to walking in the dirt most of the time. We had the stream, which was a very big part of our lives, coming down from the Jemez and flowed right along the Pueblo. It would ice over in the wintertime, and some of the best childhood memories were playing on that stream on the ice. You know, before we went to school in the morning, we'd have to cross a stream, and either we'd walk across barefooted or we'd have shoes on and slide, skate around on the ice. Sometimes we fell in and we'd get to the school wet completely soaked. I think tradition and community go hand in hand. You really, in a way, can't have one without the other, because tradition, it is really about rootedness. It is about a group of people having been alive within a place for a long period of time and having set up certain ways of behaving, certain ways of doing things. All of that is tradition. And that takes time. It takes a long time for people to feel comfortable with being in a certain place. I have to wake up every single morning, be aware of where the sun comes up over those mountains, and be careful about watching. Oh, now it's this time. Now it should be coming up right over that peak right there. And what does that mean? It means a whole lot for me, because every morning then I am in connection with that sun out there, in the sense that, no, here's my world right here. And depending on where that sun comes up this morning, I know whether I'm going to have to build a fire or not. If you see a direct connection to you in that way, you know, it's not about much more than just really seeing those different elements that come to create a place for you within which you feel comfortable and safe. What if that sun didn't come out where it was supposed to come out? I mean, the place would fall apart. Literal, I mean, there'd be no more place. But we lose that sense that if those rhythms that we just take for granted, traditional rhythms or whatever they are, if they don't continue, if I don't know that my grandmother is not going to be there and have a pot of beans going as a child, then it does start falling apart. Then there aren't rhythms. Having a grandmother is a natural rhythm as having the sun come up every day. I began to realize that there were openings in the mountains and the hills, and that the earth was breathing and moving, and clouds were coming and going, and the whole thing was happening. The wind was showing the breath of the earth. When the wind blew, the earth was breathing. What an amazing thought, that we were a part of this big, big thing that was a whole unit of a set of relationships that was just startling to me as a child, that when I looked around and could see the sky coming down and meeting the mountains and really feeling that we were within something much, much bigger than we were. And that as we breathe, so did this thing breathe. And we were breathing the same thing. We were breathing the breath of the earth, the universe. That's why the ohua, the clouds, are so important in that way of thinking, because the clouds are constantly shifting, constantly moving and changing and coming and going, reforming out of nothing almost. You look out the window and it's one form, the next second it has changed and shifted into something else. I think that we're like that as individuals and as communities. I think communities and individuals are very much organic units. And what the West does to our mind is to make us think that everything lasts forever. The whole effort in that world is to make everything last forever. It's not possible. Not in the world we live in, it's not possible. The way the old Pueblo people were trying to make sense of what was around them. You know, here, especially in the Southwest, you look around you and you see that horizon, 360-degree horizon around you. And then you see that blue with the clouds going over you. And the sense they made of it was the center. You are the center. At any point that you stand in the Southwest, you are the center and you are in containment. At any point that you stand in, you as the center. And the Pueblo people really picked up on that and said, look, we live within the earth bowl. This is where we dwell. Wherever we are at the center. Which is literally true. I mean, that's what we experience every day. We experience this in a very central way every day. And being at the center, seeing that far horizon with the mountains that contain us, in this earth bowl, and all the, you know, the symbolic kiva bowls that the Pueblo people make with the mountains along the rim of it, it is all about that. And then the earth is covered by the sky basket, And you're talking about the marriage between earth and sky. That's exactly what they were talking about, the father and the mother. But it was not in terms so much as of male and female as it was father and mother, which is a very different concept. Male and female then become included within father and mother. And that is a very different meaning than saying the male sky and the female earth, which brings in explicit kind of sexuality, which the Pueblo people weren't so much interested in as in the parental nature of mother and father within which creation happens, because it's only when the male and female come together as father and mother and children are produced that creation really happens. This is the creation right now, because those two have come around us. In that sense, then, Pueblo people talk about a community as having mothers and fathers and children. And, you know, the oldest people are always talked about as father. And then their mothers in those communities also. Many, whether they're your mothers or not, whether they're your fathers, they're known as. But then everybody else is children. But those people are also children, but the flexibility of roles in that way, but the notion of having people who are responsible and nurturing and caring about the entire context that one lives in. It's that kind of model that was taken from the way they saw the cosmos as being structured, the way the cosmos is ordered. It is within that context that we live here. Trees are living beings. Rocks are living beings. The spirit moves through the water. An incredible word that we have for the source of life is something we talk about as the po'ohan, the water, wind, breath. It is there in the water and in the wind that we can see the spirit, that we can see life moving. It's there where the life force is visible, as well as in the clouds, of course. We don't take the life force and put it in a superhuman being as Christians do with God. That already begins to show us the focus on human beings when you put the life force in a superhuman creature. We keep it within the trees, within the water, within the wind, within the clouds. And we are to move through that context of the water, the wind, and breathe the same breath that we are breathing, the same breath that the rocks do, that the wind does. That gives you a totally different feeling. This is it. There's no other reality. We don't go to heaven. We don't leave this dirty world to go to a golden, clean heaven. We are here. This is it. This is the world. Doesn't get any better than this. And if we don't honor it in the sense that this is the best, as beautiful as it's ever going to be, then we can't take care of it if we think that it's a place to be shunned and that we have better things to look forward to. Then we can't walk respectfully where we are at this moment and take care of things and touch things with honor and breathe each breath. That's what that water, wind, breath is about. It's my goodness, here it is, and every second I can breathe it in and I become a part of this world. In no uncertain terms, I am a part of this world that I live in every second because I breathe it every second. The old ancestral people moved through this region for thousands of years. And the intimacy that they developed with the land, I think, is what has kept them going for so long in such a place. And even today, I think we've forgotten that has helped our people survive for so long, is that intimacy that we had with the land, with the place, with the rocks, the mountains. Part of that intimacy, of course, was, especially in this region, is to know where the water areas are. The water is seen as being absolutely important for life. Without it, creation doesn't happen. You know, it's the semen of the father that keeps creation going. But the snaking water through this region, the Rio Grande, the lakes, and of course throughout all of Pueblo mythology, the lakes are very important. All water places are extremely important, because that's without water we don't survive here. And it's so sparse that they do have to become very special places. But they're also those places at which the energy of the world is very strong, because they're also openings, places to go to the underworlds, or, you know, to other levels of existence. They're openings also into the other world. The Rio Grande is a place that is also frightening to the Pueblo people. It's frightening because it comes with incredible power. It's the power. And that's why I think that we talk about the water, wind, breath, because the power of all of creation is there. And it can be in the wind, and it is and certainly in the water, especially in that strong flowing water that we know it. You know, and the word in Tewa for Rio Grande is Osonge, the large water place.
From a Pueblo point of view, the commons is everything. It is the context that we live in. The community was always thought of as being whole. Everything was interconnected. There was always a center to it as well. And I was a center, you were a center. There were many centers as a part of the whole thing. With the Pueblo, there are so many simultaneous things that can happen at once, which is all part of the commons, I think. There are so many things that go on at the same time. The wind is blowing, the water's flowing, and we're actually walking around and talking, and it's all part of what we all share. In that Pueblo context, then, the focus was always, what is it that surrounds me all the time? But the primary thing is that we felt that it was the earth, the sky, the clouds, the wind, and that incredible term that we have, for me, says it all. It's the bo wang, huh? The water, wind, breath. That connects, it moves through our entire world in such a way that it connects everybody and everything. That becomes the commons. In the Pueblo, it really was that thing that swirls around, that blows, that moves, that creates that sense of commons. It's the ultimate of what is common to every living being. The trees, with the rocks, with all of that, that makes our life what it is today.
At Santa Clara, all of the songs during those events talk about movement through land, through the geographical space. We talk about the young women, young men, clouds. There they are now, they're on top of that peak. Or during the goat dance that happens, now the old goat woman is coming over this peak. Now it's over at this valley, now it's over on those hills, now it's there, and finally now it has come to our place, it has come to the center. And it's usually about how the different beings on whom we're dependent as a community are moving through the landscape and are bringing in the energies that are located in those different places to this center place that we dwell in. And now they are here. Beautiful, just a rhythmical movement through the landscape, finally to the center where we dwell. And it's always in thankfulness for their moving and bringing in those, the varied kind of energies that we need from the land to this human center place. Really beautiful songs that way. You know, the amazing thing is that the basic Pueblo beliefs aren't language specific. The Hopis, for instance, speak a totally different language, Zunis, Keras, from us, and yet the major ideas of what we call the Pueblo world are the same in spite of very different languages. So it really makes me feel that relationship to land, relationship to place, which all of us experience together, we all have that basic relationship, and we talk about it in essentially the same way. Father sky, mother earth, children, this, that, the need for connection, relationship. But yet the languages are very, very different languages. They're not even related languages like with the Hopi. And yet the ideas that grew out of the land are very much the same. It was the land that dictated what we were to believe and how we were to behave. And, you know, language now is being made a big thing of because it's the one thing that people can hold on to say, that'll take us back into our traditions. Yes, it's an avenue, it's a way to do it. But the more basic thing is stop, what is our relationship to place? That's what brought up the traditions in the first place. And that's what brought up the language anyway. And the language expresses it. But it's not a dependency on language. It's something more basic.
The notion of ancestors. People think I moved here because I wanted to be where the people came from, where my people came from. A very important thing. It's very important. But I think even more important is that is for me to see how the place works right here in this tiny, tiny piece of land. On this tiny piece of land, how is it that the energy swirls right here? How can I be a part of the swirl of this place right here, this tiny place right here? And I get this from my grandmother because I think that if you can feel how a place works, how the tiny place that you're a part of works, then you don't have to worry about what the guy next door is doing. I think if you're really focused on, so intensely focused on being a part of what you know you're a part of, anyway, I don't own the land, like you were talking about earlier. We don't own the land. And she was very adamant about that. Never think that you own the place. We don't own the place. How do we walk here? How do we breathe here so that we become this place itself? How do I become this place in the best way I can become one with it? Which I am already. How do you bring that into more awareness, maybe, is what I'm trying to say. Because we are already one with it. And how do I become me aware of it?
We're all part of each other. Santa Clara Pueblo can't separate itself from Santa Fe anymore. We are living in the same place. We are living here together. And what Santa Fe does is going to affect us. And what we do affects Santa Fe. We're in it together. We're in this muddle together. And I think when it starts going down, we're all going to go down together. I don't know that water one place. How does one community have water when nobody else around them has water? It can't happen. We're not acting as if we're connected to each other. We're not acting as if communities have any sense of effect on the other one.
I think we're on a track that's going to, I don't know where it breaks, but I don't see any break in it right now, because you look at the Mexican border and the whole border issue, immigration issue we've got going right now, where people draw a line and say, you stay on that side and we stay on this side and don't you climb over the fence. We'll shoot you. I see it just moving more and more in that direction right now. And I think it'll keep going until something very drastic happens. And I don't know what that place is, what that point is. What happens to us right now with that oil spill that's going on? That's my goodness, humans taking on the power to think that they can control the the resources down in the middle of the earth. We're such prideful creatures that we think we can do all of that stuff without much consciousness of what we're doing, of where we're... Why are we doing that anyway? Except to keep the cars running faster and faster. It seems like we're bound. We're in such a fast lane that it's got to collapse at some point. And when that collapse comes, maybe we wait for the collapse to come.
and it becomes the beginning of something new. And that's another Pueblo thought, you know, that notion of, oh, this is a cycle. The wind starts blowing, and it gets bigger and bigger, and it keeps going, and there's no way to stop it. There's absolutely no way to stop the swirling of the wind when it picks up on itself. And we aren't too much different than the wind is in that sense. We become a part of this, of a cycle of thinking, of action that we've taken on. What happens to the wind? How does it stop? We certainly can't stop it, but how does it stop? We try and stop the water with dams, and that works for some time. But if there's enough water in it, look at the water that just goes over and flooding down south again and coming over the banks. And so it's all very interesting phenomena that I think that we don't identify with enough. We don't identify with being a natural force. Humans are a natural force that, I guess maybe we acknowledge just who we are. We acknowledge we are, wind can be very destructive. Water can be very destructive. So can we. I don't know if we get to that point of thinking of ourselves as natural forces. I think that the Pueblos have now joined the rest of the world in lifestyle. And I think that there isn't the concern with being in connection with the land, with the water, with the birds, with the trees, that it's gone to really going to work 8 to 5, having a job outside the community. And the swirl of life in the community is really disrupted by the kind of economic system that we've given ourselves to, which is you work from 8 to 5, and then the rest of the time you're supposed to recover so you can go back to work from 8 to 5. And there isn't any more that real vitality that happens in a community that is about just living there, just being there. We've really moved away from that. But what we do have left are the remembrances of the way it used to be. And also, I think there's some knowledge there that is still very, very important for the rest of the world. And that is how we do live in this place that we are a part of. How we acknowledge that the mountains do contain us, embrace us, that the sky overhead is still something that we need to relate to. And, you know, it's so dry out there right now. I walk around in my yard and I walk through it and it's just dusting up again. It's that we seem to go through cycles of that sort where the dust is just kicking up and blowing around. What we were before all of this going to work stuff and being so concerned with buying the latest gadget or whatever we need to buy, was that we were really concerned with talking to the clouds, talking to the wind, talking to the water, and being one with all of those forces that we really, really need to be in touch with. We become so separated from that reality, from the real reality. And, you know, all I can do is look at the sun, the shadows, and really be happy that I'm here at this moment and act accordingly. If I'm thankful, I better act accordingly.
On October 30th, 2015, Rena Swensel passed from this lifetime. She was the wisest of the wise, and of an evolved consciousness that is so rare in today's cultural perspective. Today on Encounters with Consciousness, we've heard from Rena Swensel and different fellow creatures from within the Tewa world of northern New Mexico. Encounters with Consciousness is a production of the Lore of the Land and funded by a generous grant from the Christensen Fund in San Francisco. For the Lore of the Land, this is Jack Leffler. Thank you for listening.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. To support the program, you can go to radiocafe.org. Many thanks to StudioX.com for their technical support and web design.